We all have that one movie that scared us to the core, haunted our dreams, gave us phobias we had never even thought of before, kept us up at night, and made us run and jump into our beds for fear that something may be following us in the dark. Most of us saw these movies in our adolescence, formative times in our lives. One movie I saw way too young was The Others. A beautiful, gothic-style supernatural thriller with Nicole Kidman. I remember renting it with my parents for family movie night. My mom was skeptical at the Video City when we picked it up. But I was about 12 at the time, and I swore I wouldn't get spooked out. It was a PG-13 and billed as a psychological thriller. So my parents took the gamble. Needless to say, I did get spooked out. No spoilers here, but the scene where the little girl is sitting on the floor in her confirmation dress playing with the marionette still gives me chills. For nights, I sat up with my bedroom light on, terrified my curtains would pull back on their own accord, scared my door would open and slam by itself. And I kept my eye on any and all shadows in the space. It took me weeks to get over that film. And I'm not ashamed to say that it still terrifies me to this day. By the time I had gotten over The Others, I was then introduced to my next great fear. In the seventh grade, I was invited to a slumber party at a classmate's house. Shelby was a new friend, a popular girl, and I was honored by the invite. That night, we all piled into Shelby's suburban living room, and her parents gave us the typical, "Don't stay up too late, remember to brush your teeth, and keep the noise down," parting words. Then, with a flick of the light switch, they headed down the hall to bed. Another slumber party girl suggested we watch a movie, a nice, quiet activity. In Shelby's parents' DVD collection was The Sixth Sense. Although it was several years old at this time, I had never seen it. I wasn't allowed to after the whole The Others incident. Some of the girls groaned as they already knew the twist, but still we popped it into the DVD player. As soon as the spyglass logo came upon the screen, I knew this was a bad idea. I should have asked the girls to turn it off, ask for a different movie or another round of Truth or Dare. But I didn't. I sat there, glued to the TV for all 108 minutes of it. All the girls around me fell asleep, but not me. I greeted each and every one of them with a relieved good morning as daylight flooded the living room. Once again, for weeks, I kept the light on at night. I had dreams of the little boy offering to show Cole where his dad kept his gun, haunted by the memory of Misha Barton throwing up in the red tent, and tortured by the unbelievable sadness that is the ending of that movie. It truly messed with me. But secretly, I loved it too. When I was in high school, I watched The Exorcist with some girlfriends. I liked it. It was well thought out, strong story, and an honest classic. But it didn't scare me. However, a few years ago when I read the book, my entire perspective and understanding of the story changed. Perhaps it was the power of William Peter Blatty's writing, or just my more mature adult viewpoint. But what I read was a truly terrifying story about an innocent little girl possessed by the most sinister evil on earth. She didn't seek it out. She didn't invite it in. And she didn't commit some terrible sin that the cosmos was punishing her for. She was 100% a victim, a child. The story took on a whole new level of malevolence for me. It kept me up at night. What if this happened to me, my child? What would I do? Would I have the strength to combat it? How do you protect yourself from this type of boundless evil? And say you did survive it. How do you make sure that it never happens again? friends, it's Becca. For the past 3 years, the West London Witch team have been dedicated to bringing you the best supernatural stories at the highest studio quality. And by team, I mean me and my buddy Danny. We do this work totally for free because we love it. We're proud of our content and appreciate the wonderful interactions we get to have with storytellers and listeners just like yourself. If you're enjoying the West London Witch, maybe consider joining our Patreon. It's a way to further engage with us and show your support for Two Creatives. If you're in a position to spare enough each month for us to grab a cup of coffee in between edits or add to the piggy bank for a new microphone, we would love to see you in our Patreon community. But I know times are tough, so if you're not in a position to join Patreon right now, that's okay. We aren't going anywhere. Head on over to patreon.com/The West London Witch. For as little as £1, $1, €1 a month, you can gain full access to our coven, a space where we share behind-the-scenes stories, dive deeper into each episode, answer your questions, and have special little treats to thank you for sharing your love and kindness with your favorite little witch. Hello, and welcome to episode 57 of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. We all know about the book and the subsequent movie, The Exorcist. But did you know it was based off a true story? As scary as William Peter Blatty's take on the tale is, the real story is much darker and even more wild. Today, author and podcaster Jeff Belanger pulls back the curtain and shares his research with us so that we can better understand this story. Jeff is the host of the New England Legends podcast and also the writer and researcher for the TV show Ghost Adventures. Prepare yourself. This is a heavy story. I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is The West London Witch, episode 57, The Possession of Roland Doe.
I think, like most people, I was introduced to the story of The Exorcist and the boy Roland Doe through the movie The Exorcist, which was based on the book by William Peter Blatty, The Exorcist, which really hit home for me because I was raised Roman Catholic. And I was, you know, pretty young when the movie came out. In fact, I was not quite born yet, but that movie lingered. It still lingers, really, decades later. People still talk about it. And those who know that it's based on a true story. And the true story is that of a young boy, not girl, like it was depicted in the movie, but a young boy named Roland Doe being the anonymous last name, like John and Jane Doe.
On August 10th, 1949, the Washington Post published an article entitled The Haunted Boy. The article recounted a story of a young boy called Roland Doe. A collection of notes had been leaked to the publication about Roland's experience with the demonic, and later the team of priests who cured him. This article was seen by William Peter Blatty, who was so taken by the piece, he researched it further.
And those notes were really never meant to come to light, but William Peter Blatty got his hands on them. And that's when we learned a lot more about this specific case that was quite profound in the Catholic Church, but was one of probably many that nobody really would have ever known about if not for the book and then the movie and then people asking more questions like what really happened. So the story of Roland actually begins in Cottage City, Maryland, which is a small town in a 1940s middle-class neighborhood. And something was going on in the home of young Roland.
The strange events all began on January 15th, 1949, in Roland's Cottage City home. Roland's grandmother was a spiritualist, and the two sat down to play with the Ouija board together. This may seem like an odd activity for a grandmother and grandson to engage in today, but remember, this is 1949. 23 years before the infamous novel that forever changed our views on the once family parlor game. Nevertheless, later that very day, strange activity began to unveil itself.
And suddenly they start hearing like scratching noises coming from the wall, as if maybe it's a rodent or something like that. And then there's some thumping on the wall. And this goes on for days, but they just figure, well, it's something related to the house or whatever. Just a rodent problem. But they didn't stop, even after the exterminator came and sprayed poison. But they did stop briefly when Roland's aunt Tilly died January 26, 1949. So just a few weeks later. Now, she died back home at her home in Richmond Heights, Missouri. And she had multiple sclerosis. She had hypertension. She was only 54 years old.
So Aunt Tilly dies on the 26th. But from the leaked notes, we can see that the priests recount that on January 30th, the sounds became audible once more. The diary entry reads as such. When the sound became audible again, it was no longer in the upstairs bedroom, but had moved downstairs to the boys' bedroom. It was heard as the sound of squeaking shoes along the bed and was only heard at night when the boy went to bed. The squeaking sound continued for 6 nights. And on the 6th night, scratching was again audible. The mother, grandmother, and boy, while lying on the bed that night, heard something coming towards them, similar to the sounds of marching feet and the beat of drums. The sound would travel the length of the mattress and back again and repeat this action until the mother asked, "Is this you, Aunt Tilly?" The mother continued asking questions but had no verbal reply. She asked the question, "If you are Tilly, knock 3 times. There were waves of air striking the grandmother, mother, and boy, and 3 distinct knocks were heard on the floor. The mother asked again, "If you are Tilly, tell me positively by knocking 4 times. 4 knocks were heard. Then followed a claw scratching on the mattress.
So imagine you're in the room and you hear the sound of marching feet. And at this point, Roland's mother thinks it's the ghost of Aunt Tilly. She even calls out, "If you're Aunt Tilly, knock 3 times. And she hears 3 knocks on the wall. They all do. And then February 17th, Roland's mother arranged to have him spend the night at a Lutheran minister's parsonage because she believes that whatever was haunting them seemed to be targeting the boy. And so she wanted to keep him safe. He wasn't sleeping well. Maybe he could get some rest there.
However, no rest came to Roland that night either. As he laid tucked into his bed in the parsonage, he drifted off to sleep, only to be awoken by his bed shaking and a chorus of scratching noises filling the room.
And the minister thinks this is really curious, and then a chair right near the bed tips itself over. And now, of course, the minister's a little shaken up. He thinks someone's just overreacting, but, you know, if you want to spend the night here, that's okay. Now things start to escalate. Roland's being tormented. He's being scratched by unseen forces and words are starting to form on his body. And at one point, the word Lewis appears in a scratch on his stomach. Now, his mother was from St. Louis and she took this to mean that she had to get her son out to St. Louis, out to Missouri, and maybe he would find some sort of escape from whatever is plaguing him out there.
Things were swiftly ramping up. The activity was quickly escalating, and the family and Roland were obviously terrified. Roland's mother asked the unseen force when they needed to leave. Magically, the word Saturday appeared on the child's hip. Next, she asked how long they needed to remain in St. Louis. And upon Roland's chest, raised a red scratch that stated, 3.5 weeks. It is reported that these words came about with zero participation from Roland. He was not writing the words on himself, and no one saw his hands move. He was in pain as the letters formed, and he even had markings on his back, which he could not possibly reach.
And so Roland is brought to St. Louis, and he stays at his Catholic aunt and uncle's house in the Belnor section of the city. And it's this small brick house, looks like all the others on the street. And though he was brought here to escape his demons, this is where things really get worse. And the battle between the church and the demon that is inside of Roland really begins. Now, his Catholic aunt believed that there was something diabolical attacking her nephew, and so she reaches out to the clergy right away. She's Catholic. There's a whole process in place for this. The church comes, they begin the investigation, and they start to observe things like his mattress would move and shake. The scratching noises are heard constantly. It's following the boy. It's not rodents. It's not anything else. And he's being scratched on his body through his clothes.
A parade of priests began to come to the home to help Roland and his family. They would splash holy water in the room and watched Roland react violently. Roland's bed would shake vigorously, and more scratches painstakingly drew themselves upon Roland's flesh. They tried blessing the house and the family members, but it only seemed to have adverse effects. And the activity never ceased.
And that's when two Catholic priests get involved, Father William Bowdern and Father Walter Halloran. Now, these two are going to become the real stars of the show at this point. They're both, one of them is a former army chaplain during World War II. He's battle tested. He's seen some stuff. They're both in strong mind, body, and faith. And they believe there is something diabolical going on.
Armed with the belief that Roland needed more help than they could provide, they began an appeal to the Catholic Church to push this case to the next level.
They start this process. In the Catholic Church, you don't just knock on the door and ask for an exorcism. There has to be an investigation, even back then. So the priest would investigate. They would get medical doctors to review, psychiatric professionals. And if they can rule out everything else, then they proceed to the next step. It involves the diocese up to the bishop to the cardinal, and so on. Because in the Catholic Church, an exorcism isn't between a priest and a demon in a body. That priest wouldn't stand a chance. It has to be authorized all the way up to Rome, because it's the whole of the Catholic Church against the demon, acting through the priest. And that's why there's so much protocol involved with going through this. So these priests are going through the process. The boy's spending the night at the rectory with the priest, and it's following him there too, and it's just getting worse and worse. So around March 1949, things really start to go through the process of exorcism. Prayers are said, holy relics are placed under the boy's pillow, crosses are falling off the wall. The boy's starting to speak in voices that don't sound like it's his. He's speaking languages he shouldn't know, and it's getting worse and worse, and it's getting violent. They're holding the boy down. They're tying him down. And at some point, they move him from his aunt and uncle's house to the Alexian Brothers Hospital, which is a Catholic hospital in St. Louis. And there he's put in a room. And this is where the real focus of the exorcism takes place.
From March 1949 into April, this exorcism ritual goes on and on and on. The priests are tireless in their attempts to exorcise whatever is taking over poor Roland. Endless prayers are said. Holy medals, relics, and water adorn every corner of his room. The priests are trying to battle the demon while also keeping young Roland safe. But nothing is changing. Beds still shake. Scratches still appear. Unseen forces are moving furniture and tossing about holy relics and vials of holy water. And Roland is becoming ever more weakened by the constant assaults. What happened to Roland over the next few days of the exorcism is absolutely horrifying. At the utterance of the Lord, the Blessed Saint Mary, or Saint Michael, hideous scratches began to erupt all over Roland's legs, back, stomach, face, and throat. Roland would writhe in pain as a picture of a devil carved its way onto his right leg, and the word hell scrawled itself across his chest. When asked how many demons resided in the child, a dark X formed on his skin. When Roland did fall into a restless slumber, prayers continued to be showered over him. When prayers to Saint Michael began, Roland had a physical response. An ominous smile crept upon the child's face, and he began to laugh. Two grown men had to hold Roland down as he engaged in a physical altercation with the demon. A frantic, tantrum-like battle ensued between the child and the unseen. He seemed to have superhuman strength, not that of an exhausted young man. When Roland did sleep, it was fitful. He spat at those in the room reading prayers over him. He spat at Father Bishop and even spit in his own mother's face. He would sing muddled melodies in a high-pitched voice not of his own, and even bit at those trying to restrain him from hurting himself. At one point, Roland was seen retching, as though he was trying to vomit up the demon. He asked for the window to be open and then joyfully reported that, "He's going! He's going! He's gone!" However, only a few hours later, as Roland twisted from the stomach pain, he began to say, "He's coming back. He's coming back." This was followed by a day of barking like a dog and gnashing his teeth. Once the barking subsided, Roland broke out into a beautiful, clear song. Once again, in a voice that was not indicative of Roland. Then, Roland's language turned rancid and foul. Streams of filthy obscenity flowed from his mouth. He spoke of his body and the priests in a sexual manner. All horrifying and totally out of character for the young 13-year-old boy.
So on April 18th, 1949, when things really come to a climax with this case, Father Bowden forced Roland to wear a chain of metals and hold a crucifix in his hand. And this is just absolute torment for whatever's inside. They're saying prayers in Latin. And that's when, the father asks, who am I talking to? Who is this? And the boy cries out in a deep, dark voice, "Satan, Satan, I am Satan."
On Monday, April 18th, the exorcism came to a crescendo. The prayers, the communions, and the calling upon St. Michael seemed to be working. At 10:45 p.m., Roland was racked by yet another seizure. However, in the midst of the madness, Roland remained calm, not the usual violent fit.
And that's when Father Bowden commands Archangel Michael to vanquish this demon. It builds up. And then finally, Roland looks up and says, "He's gone. This thing is gone. This thing that's been inside me for months is gone." And he finally finds peace.
Roland described that as the demon left his body, he saw the most glorious, bright white light. In the light stood a man in a fitted white robe with billowing wavy hair. He could only see the upper portion of the man, but in his right hand he held a fiery sword, and in his left, he gestured downward toward a pit. Roland said he saw the devil standing in the pit, and he could feel the fiery heat flowing from the dark hole. The angel looked at Roland, smiled, and then said, "Dominus." As soon as the word had been spoken, the devil and 10 minions fled into the fiery pit. Bars appeared over the opening, and the word "spite" was printed across them. Roland described that as the demons fled his body, he felt a horrible pulling in his abdomen, a nasty snap, and then utter relaxation.
And the case was so profound, at the Alexian Brothers Hospital, they removed all the furniture from that room, and it was placed in storage on a military base nearby. And at that point, it kind of got lost. Everybody was completely spooked by this case. Anybody that knew anything about it, anybody that was around it, knew how profound it was. So Father Bowden, after this, he lost a bunch of weight. He was sick for weeks. He was absolutely drained. I had the opportunity to actually speak to his niece about this whole thing. And he used to talk about it, just about, what a big case it was and how it affected the rest of his life, how much it drained him. And then Roland eventually goes back to Cottage City, Maryland, and goes on to live his life. And his identity was always kept secret. I did find out who he was, and I was able to track him down. And this was back a few years ago, maybe like 7-8 years ago at this point, Ghost Adventures. I'm the writer and researcher for that show, and we were filming our 100th episode at the house. The only building that's left, the Alexian Brothers Hospital, is gone. It's been taken down. The rectory where the priests were is gone. The Cottage City, Maryland house is gone. So the only building left is the aunt and uncle's house that's still there. And so we filmed an episode of the show there, the 100th episode special. And I even contacted the military base where the furniture from Roland's room had been sent. And I spoke to one of the officers who I think gave me a truly honest answer. I said, look, this stuff was allegedly moved there in the late 1940s and put under lock and key in your storage. And he's like, I can tell you right now, if something was put out in our storage and it was just like hospital room furniture, I mean, you know, waves of people come and go through here. New officers come in. At some point, someone probably looked at all that dusty stuff and just probably tossed it. And that's probably a very honest answer. I mean, I doubt that they have some demon chamber at this military base that has become, you know, something that the soldiers have to guard. So the case is one of these things that it was meant to be forgotten. Catholic Church is supposed to keep this secret and let the boy go on with his life. And he did. And while working on this episode, I actually got in touch with Roland's daughter-in-law, ex-daughter-in-law. And she said she was married to Roland's son for years, went to family events, all this other stuff, and didn't even know until they were about to get divorced that her father-in-law was Roland Doe, the boy that the whole exorcist thing was based on. I found his address. I sent him a letter because I had no other way to get in touch with him. He lives on the East Coast, that's all I'll say, up north. And I found his address and I mailed it to him. And I just said, I would love to talk to you in any capacity. If you're willing to talk about ghost adventures, that would be amazing. If you want to talk to me, I'm an author. I would love to hear your side of the story, anything. And I gave him my phone number and my email and my mailing address. And I never heard back. And at this point, he would be pretty darn old if he's still alive.
This story has been told and retold hundreds of times. The facts in each retelling can be drastically different, which is why I'm thankful for Jeff for sharing this fact-driven account. We don't need to glamorize or dramatize Roland's experience. From January 15, 1949 to April 18, 1949, Roland and his family were terrorized, brutalized, and traumatized by a spree of horrific events. I cannot imagine how painful it would have been for Roland's parents to witness their son's suffering, how Roland ever managed to move on, and how one could live with that constant fear that it could all happen again someday. What's interesting is, whether or not you believe in possession, demons, or exorcisms, the process Roland went through did cure him. Call it faith, exhaustion, or the placebo effect. Whatever they did worked, and Roland never relapsed.
Real hauntings, real terror is subtle. It's a little tiny thing. It is 1,000 paper cuts. It's not blood dripping out of the walls. It's not the house trying to eat you. Otherwise, you'd leave. You'd walk right out the door and you'd stay in a hotel and the movie would be over in 30 seconds. That's what Hollywood wants us to believe, that this terror dome is all around us, but that's not the reality. The reality is really worse because you live in constant fear. You don't know if it's around the next corner. You don't know when this thing's going to act up or not act up or leave you alone or why. Nothing, there's no rhyme or reason to it. And that's what makes it so horrific.
Do you have a spooky story you'd like to share? I'd love to hear it. Drop me an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com or find us on Instagram and Facebook at thewestlondonwitch. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And come and follow us for additional content on Instagram and Facebook. Until next time, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Miss Sinead Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them with us.